Good morning. I'm Veronica Rickert in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Monday, the 11th, and it's time for All Things Political. This hour, we'll look at how the presidential race is shaping up now that Mitt Romney is the chosen one for the Republican Party. Also, allegations that the White House is leaking classified information. And Governor Walker on CBS's Face the Nation and possible VP picks for Mitt Romney. Our guest this hour will be Molly Ball. She is a staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. And we want to know what you think about how the presidential race is shaping up, about the ad money spent, maybe about your hopes for a VP pick for Mitt Romney. Who would complete that ticket? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And we are trying to reach Molly Ball now. So go ahead and get your calls in early. We'll start taking calls right away as we try to reach Molly Ball of The Atlantic. And in the meantime, let's take a listen to this clip of Governor Walker on CBS's morning show.
Oh, I think people like Paul Ryan and others, and I hope that he goes big and he goes bold. I think he's got the capacity to do that. I don't think we win if it's just about a referendum on Barack Obama. I think it's got to be more. I think voters are hungry. In my state, a good example, I had people in the last couple of weeks of my election come up to me and say, I voted for your opponent the last time, but I'm voting for you now. And the reason for them was simple. They said, finally, someone is willing to take on the tough issues facing our state, the economic and the fiscal crisis we faced in our state. People are so hungry for leaders to willing to be able to stand up and take on those decisions. I think the governor can do that as well.
And a clip there from CBS's Face the Nation. And we are joined now by Molly Ball, staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. Molly, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Thank you. And we heard a clip there of Wisconsin's Governor Walker on CBS's Face the Nation this weekend. What do you make of his message there?
I've always thought it was very interesting the way Walker framed this, really from the beginning. I remember interviewing him and seeing him speak months ago, months before the recall, and this was the way that he framed it. It was a referendum to him, not on any particular issue, but on the idea of political courage, on the idea that anyone could sort of make grand gestures in politics instead of just coming in and being content to manage the situation or make incremental adjustments. And so it's very clear that having won the recall, that is the message he's taken away from it as well, that the voters said they do want leaders who come in and take bold action, take decisive strides, that even though he experienced so much blowback from the sort of scale of the change that he attempted to enact, he believes now he's been vindicated.
And it sounds as though he's saying that Mitt Romney should take a page from Ronald Reagan's playbook, come in with a vision.
Right. I mean, and I think this is through the lens of his own experience, right, that he is urging Romney to, in a similar way, take stands that are perceived as courageous and have an agenda that is explicit, that is bold. I think Walker's critics would point out that that's not exactly the way Walker got elected in the first place, right? He sort of sold himself in the 2010 election as much more of a not necessarily super accommodating, but a moderate, someone who could work across the aisle. And then when he came in, enacting these collective bargaining reforms that were not explicitly part of the agenda that he campaigned on. So it is interesting to hear him say that this is the way he wants Romney to campaign.
And are people listening? I mean, he was certainly on the front page last week, but now that I guess maybe things have died down a little bit, is he still capturing the country's attention?
That's a very good question. I don't have a sense that he's, you know, a key advisor to the Romney campaign, although Romney and Paul Ryan appear to be quite close. I was at CPAC Chicago on Friday, and it was interesting that, you know, this is a regional offshoot of the Conservative Political Action Conference, where there were a number of speakers, many of whom were sort of on the vice presidential shortlist, and Republican rock stars like Chris Christie and Bobby Jindal and Bob McDonnell. Every single one of them, 2-1, started their speech with praise for Scott Walker and a shout out to the recall. And there was a real sense of energy around that and a lot of cheers from the audience of thousands of sort of Midwestern conservative activists. So he really has become a rock star in the conservative movement and a hero to the conservative grassroots nationally. But there is also still a sense that he's still pretty immature as a national political figure. He only polled 2% of the CPAC vice presidential straw poll. And a lot of the attendees I talked to said, first of all, we don't want him on a national ticket because we feel like we still need him in Wisconsin. And and then they also said, you know, he's only been on the scene for a couple of years as governor. They'd like to see him grow into that role and mature a little bit more before they thrust him into that spotlight.
Well, speaking of the straw poll, tell us how other folks performed on it for the VP pick for Mitt Romney.
Well, the number one finisher was Marco Rubio. He also won the last CPAC vice presidential straw poll several months ago before the nomination had been decided. Rubio, the senator from Florida, has done a very good job of cultivating both the sort of Tea Party grassroots and also the sort of Republican establishment. He started to make himself a national voice on foreign policy as well. Rubio was not at the conference, whereas Christie was, and Christie came in second place with 14%. Paul Ryan, I believe, was third, and he also was not there. I thought it was interesting that Christie didn't do better. He gave a pretty electrifying speech, and people really, really were blown away by him. But when I talked to people about him, they said he's too big for the number two slot. They don't see him as playing second fiddle to everybody, and Christie has sort of said the same thing about his personality. And they also don't want somebody who has the potential to overshadow Mitt Romney or to be a distraction from Romney's focus on the president.
Which brings us to the title of your latest piece on this. Is anybody boring enough to be Mitt Romney's running mate? What do you mean by that?
Well, there is this conventional wisdom that's emerged, at least here inside the Beltway, that Romney does want a safe pick, that the ideal vice presidential choice for him is much more in the Joe Biden than the Sarah Palin mold.
Is that because conservatives are feeling burned by the way the Sarah Palin nomination played out last time?
No, actually. You still hear a lot of conservatives who pine for someone who would really light them on fire like Sarah Palin did, because they don't get that sense of excitement from Romney. But at the same time, there's an acknowledgement that the way Romney is likeliest to win is by making this as pure a referendum on the president as possible, and by keeping the focus there. And even though conservatives still have a lot of love for Sarah Palin, the sort of conservative or activist grassroots, the more, Republican political professional class, more the inside the Beltway types, have a lot of buyer's remorse about Sarah Palin and don't want that kind of a distraction. I think it is generally agreed by those people that she was a drag on the ticket and she distracted from the McCain campaign and created too many unnecessary headaches. So they'd like to see someone who's boring for all of those reasons. Someone who doesn't overshadow Romney, doesn't make Romney look less dynamic by comparison, and doesn't distract or create unnecessary headaches.
What do you think is the skill set that they're looking for to complete this ticket? Where are the gaps in what Mitt Romney has or what he needs?
Well, one obvious area where he could use some bolstering is in foreign policy, where he doesn't have his own experience in that area. And Washington experience, governing experience, given that his only experience in government has been as a one-term governor of Massachusetts, to have somebody who has been in Washington. And I think that's become a little bit of the mold in the last couple presidential elections with a Dick Cheney or a Joe Biden, who is seen as, because we these days seem to like outsiders to be our presidents, we like the idea of someone coming in who hasn't been in Washington or hasn't been in Washington long, who's sort of a breath of fresh air. And I think it's different than what you saw in the past, where the vice president was much more a junior figure. But with someone like a Dick Cheney or Joe Biden, who is older and more experienced than the president himself. It's more of a sort of a graybeard figure, right? And someone who is sort of can be the president's guide to the ways of Washington. And you can, of course, argue about the effectiveness of those two figures in particular. But I think that would be helpful for Romney as well, and that's part of the reason you hear talk about people like Senator Rob Portman, who has experience in a previous presidential administration and also in the Senate.
I notice we're not hearing a lot of women's names so far.
There have been a few women who've been talked about. The one you hear the most often is Susana Martinez, the governor of New Mexico, although she has said that she would not be interested. But there's you know, an obvious sort of political upside, as well as whatever policy chops she brings to the table in having a Hispanic woman who's governor of a Western, arguably swing state out there in New Mexico. There are not a lot of women's names that you hear in general on the list. Michelle Bachmann spoke at this CPAC conference, but you generally do not hear that she's being considered. Senator Kelly Ayotte from New Hampshire has been a quite effective surrogate for Romney and gets along quite well with Romney himself, but that's seen as being too much of a Northeast-centric ticket if she were to be on it, and she also is not terribly experienced. So no, you don't hear a lot of women's names.
So in terms of the vice president, in terms of just all the factors that go into completing the ticket in general, it seems as though all of them might matter a little bit more in November because it's projected to be such an incredibly tight race. Is that still what you're hearing?
It is true that in a close election, every little bit counts, every tiny marginal advantage, every, you know, wedge issue and tiny distraction or whatever. But I don't think vice presidential nominees have a huge impact on the outcomes of presidential elections. And I don't think that's likely to change. And you know, as I was talking about with Sarah Palin, I think a lot of times the impact is more downside than upside. So there's not a lot of ways that a vice presidential nominee can help the ticket, except possibly by bringing in a key state. And that's why people like the idea of a Portman from Ohio or a Rubio from Florida. But it doesn't always work out that way. And so I think with the Romney camp and with Mitt Romney himself in general, his focus seems to be much more on someone who would help him govern and someone that he has a personal level of comfort with, much more than the sort of political calculation of helping him get to 270 electoral votes.
Well, in terms of the tightness of the race, we've got some unusual, I guess, ad figure so far, that most of the money or all of the money so far is being spent in these nine swing states so far, nine states, and they're targeting not even the major cities, but these medium urban areas. Tell us about how the ad dollars, what they're buying right now.
This is an interesting phase of the campaign because we are seeing the map start to settle and the air war start to engage. So you do have both campaigns doing a little bit of test buying in terms of testing different messages and testing different markets and seeing where they plan to engage. I mean, part of the reason that you say these are medium-sized markets is that most of the big TV markets, you know, New York, L.A., Chicago, Dallas, Houston, are not in swing states. So the swing states, just by definition, are going to have more medium-sized cities, and you're going to have, you know, if the two key swing states, I think the two preeminent swing states in this election are Ohio and Virginia, and both of those are cities that have are states that have several medium-sized cities rather than one of the, you know, top cities in the country, and so we'll see, you know, as the summer unrolls, I think we'll see more of that ad blitz start to unroll and the campaign sort of lock in. And, of course, by the time we get to the conventions in September, you won't be able to turn on your television in any of those states without just being bombarded.
Well, we're used to that in Wisconsin, so we're warmed up already.
Sure,
and it seems like that's the way they're going to be doing it now, right, is that they're the organizations and the PACs that are running the ads, they're going to be rolling them continuously. One run ends, another picks up where that one left off, and it's the blanket, I guess.
Yeah, and a lot of them have already reserved all of their television time all the way through the election. That's something that I kind of wonder about, actually. You hear these mind-blowing figures for how much money is going to be spent on this election, more than ever before, and you just think, what can you even do with all that money? At some point, is it just saturated? There's only a certain, and this is, you know, great for the TV business, right? And possibly the radio business as well, although not public radio, that they will have all of their airtime completely bought out. And at some point, there's just none left. So I wonder,
what do you buy?
If you reach a saturation point where you just can't spend this much money on a presidential election. Now, they'll certainly find a way, given that they have the money to spend. But, it's going to be wall-to-wall. There's no question about it.
Is there any, I know you might not be an expert in advertising, but is there any sense that the political ads themselves, the content of them, are changing? Because at least what we've seen in Wisconsin so far with the recall election, you know, they're solid ads, but they look as like what we've seen for the past,
that's
I don't
really
know how long.
Yeah, no, that's not something I've given a lot of thought, but it's an interesting question. There is sort of a stock format for political ads, isn't there? And every once in a while, you do see something that breaks the mold, like the Christine O'Donnell, you know, I am not a witch ad. And when you do, and when something like that comes along, people really do sit up and take notice, because it isn't what we're used to. But in general, I think, you know, the reason political ads all tend to look the same is because this is what people think works. And this is the way that has been honed over time as being the most effective way to deliver the message, whether it's the sort of like flags waving in the breeze as a narrator, you know, delivers a patriotic message, or the opposite, right? The ominous music and the unflattering photo of your opponent and the message about all the terrible things that you're going to do. So it does tend to be pretty stock. And I wonder if that's also something the creators of these ads think about, is how they can better sort of break through and get people's attention.
Well, you can imagine that would be a way to spend more money, to get Hollywood-style blockbuster production values in a political ad, but doesn't sound like...
Well, and Obama did that, right? Obama did that. He's got this movie that the campaign made and that Tom Hanks narrates, and that they have been using some clips from that movie in order to make some of their ads.
Well, we're talking all things political this hour with our guest, Molly Ball, staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. And we're welcoming your calls, your questions and comments now at 1-800-642-1234. And it's all on the table, politically speaking, this hour, if you'd like to talk about Governor Walker and his prospects going forward from the recall, about vice presidential picks, about the ads that we're seeing. Tell us what's on your mind, and we'll try to respond at 1-800-642-1234. And our email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you. I'm in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And it's Monday, so all things political, as we talk with Molly Ball, staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. And we take our first phone call now. We've got Willem joining us from Colfax. Hi there.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to make a comment about what Governor Walker said about someone walking up to him and saying they didn't vote for him last time, but they voted for him this time. I would find that very difficult, because he seems like he only appears in this Republican strategy of captive audience appearances, where he appears in a private factory or someplace by invitation or paid only. So he's visited Eau Claire more times than any governor I ever remember, but he has yet to appear in public. So, and as far as being courageous, unless deception is courageous, I don't find him courageous. But that's the main reason I called, was to talk about the effect of this Citizens United case on where basically money is speech, and it seems only logical by extension that the people with the most money therefore have the largest megaphone and the most speech. So that is going to take us back to before the American Revolution, the way things were money and power controlled the lives of ordinary people. And Justice Louis Brandeis said, we can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both. And I think that's very true.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your calls and your comments, I should say. And let's see what Molly has to say.
I would caution that a lot of things get attributed to Citizens United that would have been possible before that decision. A lot of the spending that we see in this election would have been possible. One of the things that Citizens United helped open the door to was direct corporate spending, but most of the PAC spending that we've seen, even the super PACs, have not been directly attributable to that decision. That being said, the money was a huge factor in the Wisconsin recall, and the supporters of Barrett and the Democrats were dramatically outspent on television, and I think a lot of Democrats in looking to explain why they lost the recall have fixated on that. There's not much to be done about it, right? I mean, if you are a Democrat and you want your side to win, you have to sort of accept this as a fact of life at this point. Unless we get a new Supreme Court, that decision isn't going anywhere, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of hope for meaningful campaign finance regulation expansion. So I think Democrats who are being realistic about their desire to win need to try to find more money and match the other side, because just sort of complaining about the fact that you're being outspent doesn't get you very far.
I know that this is a big question, but where does that money come from?
Right. Well, we'll see. Most of it has not been spent. Some of it has been pledged. And you know, one of the things that we've seen is that the super PACs are mostly on the Republican side. So while the Romney campaign actually outraised the Obama campaign in the past month, the Obama campaign is still confident that from the standpoint of just the campaign itself, where contributions are capped and regulated and disclosed, they believe they will have an advantage, as they did 4 years ago in the pure campaign fundraising. But where they'll be at a disadvantage is with the super PACs and with groups like American Crossroads that Karl Rove is a part of, and a lot of other groups spending hundreds of millions of dollars, as they have vowed to do. Now, not all of this will be on the presidential election as well, I should say. A lot of these groups are focused further down the ticket, and you have Tea Party groups as well that are not very big fans of Romney but are dedicated to electing conservatives to the Senate and to the House. And so I think you'll see a lot of these ads will not just be focused on the president or on the presidential election.
Well, we do know that Mitt Romney's campaign out-earned President Obama's last month. I think he took in almost $77 million and to Obama's $60 million. How big a deal is that?
It is and it isn't. The Obama campaign believes that is just sort of in part just a fluke of the calendar, because until he became the presumptive nominee recently, really last month, Romney was raising primary election dollars, and so this was the first month that he was able to coordinate with the Republican National Committee and raise general election dollars. And so that meant it's sort of an opening of the floodgates to a lot of the same donors that he already had on board to max out and make those big contributions. And they won't be able to do that again, or they'll have to look elsewhere for those donations in the coming months. At the same time, the Obama campaign's financial advantage 4 years ago was a major advantage for them, and having to go into this election without that advantage is a major liability for them, and they know that. And they know that they will almost definitely get outspent, particularly in TV advertising, and so they are trying to make that up chiefly through ground organization. And the question that was raised by Wisconsin was, what happens when the Republicans also have a ground game? Because I think part of what happened in the Wisconsin recall was that Republicans were able to match that ground organization that Democrats have always felt was their particular strength. And so if that happens in other places across the country, Democrats will really be at a disadvantage.
Now, lay out exactly what you mean by ground game.
This is the field operation, right? The grassroots organization, the knocking on doors and then having the offices in different communities and people talking to their neighbors and the sort of community organizing work, the get out the vote program.
What about things like social media? Is that part of the ground game, would you say?
It's an interesting question. I think they're usually considered separate, but they've largely merged in this day and age. You know, especially the internet's role in campaigns is still somewhat novel, and so the Obama campaign in particular has done a very good job of merging that with the traditional ground game.
And that was considered a strength when he was elected. And I imagine, you know, technology has caught up, people have caught up. Do we expect to see that to be an edge for President Obama this time around, or not so much?
It will absolutely be an edge. Republicans have been trying to play catch up in technology, you know, ever since the days of Howard Dean, but they haven't gotten there. And the Obama campaign has an incredibly sophisticated digital operation, both in terms of the digital outreach, like when you talk about things like Facebook and social media and their ability to reach people and to send those incredibly annoying emails all the time. but then also the internal mechanics of their digital targeting and being able to, in a sort of a really creepy way, follow you around the internet and know what you like and know how best to message you and what they should say when they knock on your door and then how they can best get you out to vote.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have joining us Hugh from Milwaukee. Hi there, Hugh.
Hi. I was wondering if you've heard any buzz about Governor Brewer of Arizona, who was glad in the attempts to enforce the anti-invasion laws of the illegal immigrants. You know, she would make a wonderful choice and would mobilize a lot of people who are conservative against the invasion by illegal aliens. Also, you know, you had this guy talking a bit earlier about Governor Walker, why he doesn't appear more in public. Remember, he has death threats against him and his family. The crazy left, the mobocrats, who have just done everything to obstruct his administration since he was elected, even pouring, you know, some stalkers, some of these left-wing stalkers pouring beer on Republicans' legislators and getting away with it because the liberal judges said all they had to do was pay for the dry cleaning.
So we know it's a pressurized environment for Governor Walker to appear in public. Molly, do you want to weigh in on those?
Well, Jan Brewer is not a name that I have heard with regard to running mate choices. And I think in part that's because, well, the caller certainly shows that she has some fans within the conservative base. She's viewed as quite polarizing, and particularly with Hispanics. Hispanic voters are going to be a targeted demographic for both campaigns. There's a lot of question about whether Romney went too far to the right during the Republican primary on immigration, and that will make it difficult for him to cut into Obama's advantage with Hispanic voters. The last poll I saw, it was a national poll, found Obama had something like a 34-point lead with Hispanic voters, and he'll be trying to, you know, register and get out as many Hispanic voters as he possibly can. So I think for that reason, because Governor Brewer is so strongly associated with that Arizona law, the SB 1070, I don't think she would be considered.
As far as immigration goes, obviously the talking point of the election will be the economy and the economy and the economy, but will immigration show up there as a flashpoint at all?
Well, you do have both campaigns aggressively targeting Hispanic voters, and although, you know, when you poll Hispanic voters, immigration is not their number one issue, it is an issue with a lot of power. Hispanic voters, like voters everywhere, are concerned about the economy first and foremost, but at the same time, the immigration is seen as so sort of specific to the Hispanic community that it's a very sort of hot button. And so you've had both campaigns recording ads in Spanish, the Obama campaign or possibly actually the Democratic Super PAC, I think, just went up with a new Spanish language ad in some key states. And so they're going to be pushing very, very hard. And I think that the challenge, again, is much more about turnout. Hispanic voters do seem to favor the president by a wide margin, but there's still a sense that he hasn't done all he could, especially on immigration. And so it may be difficult to convince the Hispanic electorate that it's worth their while to vote at all.
And thank you to Hugh. Another call now. Luke joins us from Little Chute. Hi there, Luke.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I was wondering, as Governor Romney considers his running mate, if he were to look at Governor Walker, how much does the John Doe investigation, how much does that play into his decision and the uncertainty that goes with it? And, for example, if he were to select him and later charges were filed, couldn't that bring down his whole candidate? Thank you.
All right, thank you. Molly?
Yeah, I think the caller makes a very good point. This is one of the chief reasons that Romney is looking for someone as, quote-unquote, boring as possible, is he wants someone who doesn't have baggage. And so I think absolutely something like the John Doe investigation that has not so far entangled the governor himself but is sort of hanging over his head and casting a dark cloud over his administration would absolutely be something that they would want to avoid because you just want as little uncertainty as possible. You don't want any sort of landmines in the road ahead that could possibly trip things up.
Do you think that that question of baggage is one that, I don't know, a candidate, how thoroughly do they vet the VP candidates, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Sarah Palin, obviously they knew they were picking someone with a lot of charisma and star power, but she burned so bright that she burned some of the people around her as well. I mean, how thoroughly do they vet the candidates before they go in?
I think this year there will be a very thorough vetting process. Again, in part because of that buyer's remorse from the Sarah Palin choice, there is a sense of wanting to make sure that there are no surprises. And so part of that is just a lesson learned from the Palin experience. And part of that really reflects the different personalities of these two nominees. John McCain is much more of a risk taker. He is much more the kind of person who likes to take a gamble and shoot for the moon, right? Whereas Mitt Romney, you can just tell the kind of person he is. He's very cautious. He's very deliberate. He doesn't like to be surprised. He wants to always have all of the I's dotted and the T's crossed. So I think partly as a reflection of his personality as well, the vice presidential selection process will be very deliberate.
Now, we've been talking about how Wisconsin will shape up since the recall last week, and people talking about how big a deal you could make of Wisconsin's decision to keep Scott Walker in the governor's office. How much that matters toward the national election? How much can we read into it? What is your take on that?
Not too much. I would definitely caution against anybody saying, oh, now Wisconsin is definitely, you know, going to be one of the biggest swing states in the fall. Even Republicans still see it as sort of on the bubble, swing state-wise, and probably leaning toward Democrats. There's a couple reasons for that. Number one, you saw in the exit polls that the same electorate that voted to retain Walker still said they also would have gone for Obama if the presidential election were held today. And so that seems to be a sign that there are, particularly independent voters, there seem to be some voters, you know, there are Obama-Walker voters in the electorate. And the theory that convinces that I find most convincing is that these are people who basically don't want to change horses in midstream, right? They want to stick with the status quo. They feel like the economy, the people in charge of fixing the economy deserve more of a chance to keep doing what they're doing, whether that's the president or the governor. And then the second reason that the recall doesn't tell us who's going to win the general election is that it will be a different electorate.
Yeah, explain that. That's interesting. What would be different about it?
Well, more people will vote. It's just true that
well,
more
maybe
people
not
vote
in Wisconsin.
Well, you did have remarkably high turnout in the Wisconsin recall. It is true, more than the 2010 general election, which is just a shocking thing that you could have more people come out in the middle of July for an unscheduled election than for a regular midterm gubernatorial election. So you're right. Wisconsin's a special case, but it was still lower turnout than the 2008 presidential. And if we attribute some of that turnout as well to the party's incredible turnout and targeting and get out the vote machines, those will be even more revved up and formidable and effective when it comes to November. In particular, I also I heard from Democrats that they felt they would be able to dramatically increase the youth vote in Wisconsin in the fall, because right now college students are on vacation and that's a big demographic for the president.
I think it'll be interesting because you can certainly agree with everything you just said. On the other hand, we're tired.
Right. You can see that people might have a little bit of political fatigue as well.
Yeah, and you don't even have that long to recuperate.
No.
You've got a primary coming up. So this isn't even the next election that we're talking about. It's amazing.
Well, we're talking with Molly Ball this hour. She is a staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. It's all things political today, and we want to know what you're thinking about in terms of the presidential race coming up, Wisconsin's role on the national stage, vice presidential picks, whatever is on your mind, politically speaking. You can give us a ring at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 10 o'clock, it's the Front and Center Literacy Series. Most of us take literacy for granted, but for many it proves to be a lifelong struggle. WBEZ's Richard Steele hosts the first of a special three-part series about literacy in the Great Lakes region today. Today, the live call-in show explores the use of multiple languages during conversation and how we judge different ethnic-based dialects at school, the workplace, and at home. That's the Front and Center Literacy Series at 10 o'clock today. I'm Veronica Rickert, in for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network, as we talk with Molly Ball, staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. And another caller here, Wayne, is joining us from Holman. Hello, Wayne.
Hi, good morning. Thank you, Veronica, and your guests.
Morning.
Very good show. The question I posed to your screener, a young lady, was during the vote of the election between Governor Walker and Tom Barrett, at 9 o'clock at night, polls had this thing a dead heat, 50-50, they said. The Marquette poll actually had it dead on. Their polling showed 7% for Walker over Tom Barrett. Now, I know the left was very angry about the Marquette poll and accused it of bias, but that was, of course, typical liberal response. But my question and query to you would be, if they were so off the polling of different groups on the Walker-Barrett race, why should we consider them dead on when their exit polling stated that President Obama would carry Wisconsin? I don't buy it. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Wayne. Molly?
There's a couple of issues that Wayne refers to, both of which I've written about, unfortunately. So, first of all, the Marquette poll, if you're going to put a lot of stock in that, the Marquette poll also showed Obama winning the general election. The Marquette poll asked the Walker question, then they also asked the presidential election question, and I believe Obama won by a similar margin, by 8 or 9 points compared to 7 points for Governor Walker. So if you believe the Marquette poll, if you want to put a lot of stock in the Marquette poll, it found the same result as the exit polls. Second of all, why were the exit polls so wrong? And this is kind of interesting. We've seen over and over again that these early waves of exit polls get leaked and give a lot of hope, and it always seems to be the Democrats who have their hopes dashed by these leaked early exit polls that turn out to be wrong. You remember in 2004, Democrats were prematurely celebrating President John Kerry, only to find when the actual vote came in that wasn't the case. Part of the reason, it turns out, is that first wave of exit polls, which is supposed to be under embargo but which always sort of seems to get out, that first wave of exit polls reflects the people who voted in the morning. And for whatever reason, people who vote earlier in the day seem to tilt Democratic, and it also may have to do with who is likelier to talk to an exit pollster. Exit pollsters, you know, are these kids with clipboards that are standing outside your polling place, and they want to know who you voted for. And it may be the case that that Democrats, for whatever reason, are more likely to agree to talk to that person. These are sort of theories that polling experts I spoke to about this issue have come up with to explain the fact that there does always seem to be, in that early wave of exit polls, a little bit of a tilt toward the Democrats.
So Democrats vote early, Republicans vote late.
not overall. Right, it's not a rule of thumb
right.
by any means, but there does seem to be a slight lean in that direction, yeah.
I think there's an interesting sociological study there somewhere.
Absolutely.
All right, Dennis in Appleton is next. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I was just interesting when they said that people that voted for Walker also are going to vote for Obama. And I always had the theory that the reason that is Obama gave everybody a 2% raise. If you notice that instead of taking 6% out of your Social Security, it's 4%. So what did Obama do for me? Well, he gave me a 2% raise. Well, what did Walker do to me? Didn't do anything. He balanced the budget on what, 2% of the people or 3%? So 98% didn't get hurt. Or am I wrong on those statistics of the union members that are balancing the budget?
Molly?
Well, I am not familiar enough with the nitty-gritty of the Wisconsin budget to answer your specific question about the impact of the way that Walker balanced the budget. You certainly hear a lot of rhetoric from both sides, the Republicans, saying that Walker, you know, balanced the budget without. Well, I believe he did raise taxes, actually, but without increasing spending. And then the Democrats accuse Walker, of course, of cutting taxes for the rich and raising taxes on the back of the unions and the middle class. I do think the sort of larger point the caller makes, that most people don't feel like they've personally felt a negative impact from what Walker has done, I think that is part of what happened. I think that is part of the equation, that even some Democrats I spoke to felt like the Walker's biggest advantage was how much time passed between when that legislative session and the protests and the recall election, because all of the sort of sky is falling warnings from Democrats that, oh gosh, you know, these things that Walker is trying to do will be so destructive, nobody's sky really fell in, you know. And it had been, and by the time the recall came around, Walker had been in office for 16 months, and by and large, people didn't feel like the state was falling apart on his watch. They didn't feel like in their lives personally, you know, their kids are still going to school and the state services still by and large operational. And so I think that was one of the strongest advantages that Walker had.
In terms of the presidential campaign, now the two big grassroots political movements that we've seen have been the Tea Party movement and more recently the Occupy movement. And obviously the Tea Party had a lot of sway in some of the other election cycles. What role do you see those two movements playing, if any, in November?
That's a very difficult question to answer. And I think it's a different reason for both, for each of those two movements, but I have a lot of doubts about whether either one will really be a player in the presidential election. The Occupy movement has seemed to me to be targeted nearly as much toward the Democratic Party as the Republican Party, to the extent that it's politically focused at all. I mean, part of the reason it's Occupy Wall Street and not Occupy the U.S. Capitol is because they are much more focused on industry and on the financial industry than on the policy process, but they seem to me to have largely resisted being co-opted by the political party structure. So it's hard to imagine them really coming into the tent as sort of ground troops for the Democratic Party. The Tea Party very much was assimilated into the Republican Party in 2010, and it was very interesting. You know, when the movement originally formed shortly after the 2008 election, and then there was a lot of talk, oh, will they form a third party, right? Will they try to be an alternative to the two-party system? And they very consciously said, no, we want to work inside the structure of the Republican Party. We want to change the faces that represent the Republican Party, and we want to play in Republican primaries, even if that means nominating people like Sharon Angle and Christine O'Donnell that don't have a very good chance at being elected. But they very much wanted to make their impact within the Republican Party. They seem less relevant now, but I think they would say that part of the reason is that they have become part of the Republican grassroots, and they have influenced the direction of the Republican Party. You know, the House class of 2010 has certainly been a huge voice in policy and in determining the direction that House Republicans choose to take, and the Tea Party continues to have an impact in House and Senate primaries in determining who gets nominated. And then even when they don't pick a candidate and push for that candidate with ads and with a campaign effort, I think you could argue that they've had an impact on the candidates who are there anyway running to the right. There are candidates in Republican primaries who don't want to be challenged by the Tea Party. So even if they're candidates who've sort of come up through the establishment, they take a much harder right-wing tone. The Wisconsin Senate primary is going to be interesting to see if they nominate the moderate establishment candidate or one of the candidates who's trying to claim the mantle of the Tea Party. That's one of the ones I think we'll be watching.
Now, you said they seem less relevant. Is that primarily a function because the conversation has moved on, or is it because, you know, like you said, they've just integrated?
Yeah, I don't know. I think this is something we're still sort of arguing about. They're not relevant in the same way, for sure. They're not, you know, if you recall when Glenn Beck and others were having the rallies on the National Mall and hundreds of thousands of people, and it seemed like every weekend there was another one of these protests, and there was this really, as a protest movement, it seems less relevant, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. But the question is, are they still a factor? Are those people still engaged and just doing different things, which is what I think they would argue, or did those people get disillusioned and drift away and the energy, drained out of it that way? And I don't think we fully know the answer to that.
Well, let's take another phone call now. Anita is with us from Waukesha. Hi, Anita.
Hi, I'm a retired teacher from Waukesha. Waukesha is in Waukesha County, very conservative county. Waukesha was where Walker had his victory celebration. And I had worked a lot on Barrett's campaign and was very astounded that Walker won so handedly. And I don't know that you know the can give me an answer to my question, but I'm aware that there are a lot of retired teachers who voted for Walker. We had neighbors who had Walker signs in their yard who were retired teachers, and I think that's what has made me the saddest about the results of the election last week. People who know how hard teachers work, and yet they support a party that's been so demeaning to our profession. People who used the health insurance for themselves and their families that, you know, were obtained by collective bargaining, and yet they don't seem to be interested in helping newer teachers or people who are now sending their children to college or people who are now dealing with health issues where they need good insurance. So I guess, you know, I don't know that you've have an answer for me, but I guess I'm just interested, someone who doesn't live in Wisconsin, you know, how do you look at a situation like that? How do you explain that?
All right. Thank you, Anita. Molly?
That's a really fascinating observation, and one thing that we did find in looking at the exit polls and other other measures was that Scott Walker did get a pretty sizable amount of the vote in union households, and I believe it was a little over a third. And part of that is that Walker, unlike the governor of Ohio, who also tried to curtail collective bargaining for public workers, Walker exempted the police and firefighters, so he prevented some antagonism from even some of the key and some of the most Republican-leaning also public sector unions. And then also he's been careful not to antagonize the private sector unions. He's been careful to stay as far away as he can from the idea of right-to-work legislation. He said that's not something he has any interest in being a part of, although he also has not said that he would veto it. I think this is a sort of dance that he's doing because some of the conservative groups that have helped fund him and that he's a hero to would like to see right to work. So he's not against it either. but the point being that, you know, there are Republicans in unions, and there always have been. And one of the effects that we've seen already from the changes to collective bargaining that Walker enacted is that unions, public sector unions, have lost a huge amount of membership in Wisconsin. I think the American Federation for Teachers in Wisconsin, I read, has already lost a third of its members just because of the changes to collective bargaining, whether because it is now possible for public workers to opt out of the union where they couldn't before, or because he's made it harder for individual units to be certified and recognized by their employers. So you know, some of those teachers who were in the union may not have necessarily made the choice to be in the union, and now that they have that choice, may be choosing not to.
Well, thank you for that call. And we've got about less than a minute left. Quick question here from Bill on Facebook. Will the ad dollars committed through November tip a candidate's position, knowing the money will be spent lavishly on an issue? And we've got about 30 seconds for your answer.
I'm not sure I totally understand the question, whether an ad could change a candidate's position. But one thing we do know about political ads is they tend to be relatively content-free. It tends to be much more about making you feel a certain way. So I wouldn't hold out too much hope of getting a real strong sense of where the candidates stand from their political ads.
Well, Molly Ball, thank you so much for your time this hour. It's been a delight to talk with you. I'm sure you've got a busy season ahead of you as well, huh?
I sure do. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Molly Ball was our guest this hour, staff writer covering national politics for The Atlantic. And I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for answering your phone calls this hour. Brett Jaspers produced this hour's program with additional help this hour from Marika Suval. And I'm Veronica Rickard. I'll be in all this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. And keep in mind, if you'd like a copy of any of the programs you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444. Today's program was 611D. I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.